What's my subscription to the New York Times have me doing this week? Preparing a strawberry pretzel pie. Solving spelling bee with no hints. Planning a trip to one of the 52 best places to go. Getting to the bottom of the big pants trend.
Whoa.
And I'm finally replacing my vacuum with a recommendation I can trust. What will your subscription to the Times have you do? Why not find out? With our best offer, go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, the accidental president of Syria. How a man who was never meant to lead became the man who outraged the United States government with the brutality of his leadership. And why President Trump is rejecting that leader while embracing another Middle Eastern ruler with his own reputation for brutality. It's Tuesday, April 11th. When the government of Syria released the nerve gas sarin last week, choking dozens of its own civilians to death, it violated an international arms agreement in an especially gruesome way.
I should just warn all our viewers that these are pretty difficult pictures to follow.
In the early hours of this morning, there were reports of chemical weapons attacks.
Since 2011, when the Syrian civil war erupted, hundreds of thousands of Syrians have been killed, injured, arrested, and kidnapped, triggering the refugee crisis that is reshaping the politics of countries around the world. And the man at the center of that, of what has become the most notorious government in the region, is Bashar al-Assad.
Well, this is, the biggest thing to remember about Bashar al-Assad is this is not somebody who aspired to be a politician or was raised to be a politician or really put much effort into becoming a politician before it was imposed on him by circumstance.
Ben Hubbard covers the Middle East, and he's based in Beirut.
You know, Syria before him was ruled by his father, Hafez al-Assad, who took power in a military coup in 1970. And he was grooming his first son, Basil al-Assad, who was Bashar's older brother. Basil was father's oldest and his favorite son. He was good-looking. He was well-connected, both in Syria and around the region. He was very charismatic. He was an engineer. He had trained as a paratrooper and had a military background. And the local press even would refer to him as the Golden Knight because he had sort of legendary horsemanship skills.
Wow.
And in the meantime, Bashar was the second son, and he was kind of, well, he was...
I think what we'd like to see is like any other country, peace, prosperity, better living, better standard of living, reform that we've been talking about for years in our country.
He was a quiet one. He was sort of bashful, sort of nerdy, sort of self-conscious. There are stories that when he was young, he was so self-conscious about his teeth that he used to even cover his mouth with his hand whenever he laughed. He didn't pursue a military career. He didn't do any of that. He went and he studied medicine. And then after graduating and working for a while in Syria, he left the country. He got out. His father was sort of this massive, massive force during his time in the Arab world and in Arab politics. And Bashar, instead of deciding to be a part of that, decided to leave. So he moved to London, where he was doing postgraduate work to become an ophthalmologist.
An ophthalmologist. So he was going to be an eye doctor?
Yeah, he was going to be an eye doctor. So then the big change comes on a foggy night in January in 1994, when Basil, sort of this young, good-looking, strong military background son, is cruising in his Mercedes towards the airport to catch a flight to Germany and has a terrible car accident and is killed on the spot.
Wow.
So all of a sudden, Syria, which, has what is sort of on its way to being a dynastic system, has just lost its heir apparent. It's basically just lost, who could be considered the crown prince. So in very short order, Bashar al-Assad is brought home. He comes back to Syria. It became very clear to everybody that he was then being groomed to take the place of his father when he passed away. Hafez al-Assad died in 2000. And Bashar al-Assad was named president and, it was called an election, but he was actually the only candidate about a month later. And he's been the president of Syria ever since.
So you're telling me that he was different from other members of his family. How does he compare to the other notorious rulers in the Middle East?
Bashar is a pretty unique character when it comes to, you know, the dictators of the Arab world. I mean, if you look around, almost all of them have military background. They mostly came to power in military coups. I mean, you know, just to take a few examples.
Instead of respecting the rights of his own people, Gaddafi chose the path of brutal suppression.
You have Gaddafi. Mm-hmm.
Humanitarian assistance must be allowed to reach the people of Libya.
Was incredibly loud and noisy and boisterous. Loved to pose with weapons and loved to pound on the table and scream and shout. You know, you had Saddam Hussein that had a very similar background. These are guys who love to show off their military force, love to play the strongman role. Mm-hmm. You know, so this is, in this part of the Arab world, this was very much the pattern. And Bashar didn't really fit it. You know, he came back and here's this guy who trained to be a doctor and he's kind of quiet. Right. And so his public persona since then has very much stayed the same. He comes across as a very reasonable guy who speaks English and he wears, you know, well-cut suits and he's kind of mild-mannered.
The problem with the West, if I may make analogy to two computers with different systems. If you talk about Windows and Apple.
Yes, right. I don't recall ever seeing a picture of him with a gun.
Mm-hmm.
I don't ever recall seeing videos of him raising his voice and shouting about anything. I mean, he very much comes across as like your mild-mannered ophthalmologist that you might go see when you need a new pair of glasses.
Right. And now he's the leader of the country. What did the United States make of Bashar al-Assad when he succeeded his father and was named president?
So Bashar became president in 2000, and I think at the very beginning there was a lot of hope that this guy was going to be a reformer. I mean, a key piece of this was very soon after he became president, he got married. He had not been married before. So he married this woman named Asma, who became Asma al-Assad, the first lady of Syria, and she very much broke the mold. His father's wife, people knew her name, but pictures of her never appeared. She never appeared in public. And so Bashar al-Assad marries this very pretty British woman of Syrian descent who had grown up in England. Her friends there called her Emma. They didn't even call her by her Arab name. So she's this sort of pretty, stylish British woman who had worked as a banker in London at J.P. Morgan. You know, and she marries Bashar al-Assad and they come back. And Bashar very much made a point early in his rule to portray himself as kind of an everyman. There are, you know, stories that you would hear around Damascus of him showing up and eating the kinds of sandwiches that they sell on the street, things like that, mm-hmm. which are things that his father would not have done. And so I think a lot of people really hoped that this guy was going to be a reformer. And there were certain kinds of reforms. You know, he did try to come up with a more technocratic government. I think he at least publicly played down sort of the military and the security image.
Mm-hmm.
He did have a complicated relationship with the United States. I think that early on there was some hope within the government that, you know, this is somebody we can work with. And even up until 2011, I mean, you can get on YouTube and you can find a video of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton saying
there is a different leader in Syria now. Many of the members of Congress of both parties who have gone to Syria in recent months have said they believe he's a reformer. What's been happening there the last few weeks is deeply concerning.
You know, many members of Congress have gone and met with this guy and they think he's a reformer. And she says, you know, this is why we don't think it's the same thing as Gaddafi.
But there's a difference between calling out aircraft and indiscriminately strafing and bombing your own cities than police actions, which frankly have exceeded the use of force that any of us would want to see.
So that public persona definitely changed the way that the rest of the world thought about him.
Ben, that 2013 attack using chemical weapons.
There are videos of people convulsing, having difficulty breathing, with running noses, and this disturbing footage showing a shivering young man with pinpoint pupils.
Which was traced back to the Assad regime. Is that seen as a transformation of Assad? Because many Middle Eastern rulers have responded with extraordinary force to these rebellions in their countries since 2011, but only one of those governments has used chemical weapons, in this case now, twice. And I'm still wrestling with how it is that, you know, an eye doctor who is, as you've described him, mild-mannered, becomes the head of a government that uses chemical weapons against his own people.
I mean, I don't think that we, you know, there's no way for us to look in. I mean, I have no information suggesting or, you know, confirming mm-hmm. that it was actually Bashar al-Assad himself who picked up the phone and ordered the use of chemical weapons. I don't, as far as I'm aware, that has never been determined. And to this day, he'll deny that his forces ever did it, and he'll say that we didn't have these weapons and things like that. But there was a precedent for this. I mean, his father, Hafez al-Assad, you know, had faced an uprising by the Muslim Brotherhood in 1982, which he crushed with enormous force, you know, killing thousands and thousands of people. And well, in that case, it actually worked. You know, he was able to get away with it and, you know, put down the uprising and remain president for, you know, a number of years after that. So they knew how to hold on to power. And so when they were faced with a new challenge, these were the only tools that they had in the toolbox to respond to it.
Okay, how firm is Assad's hold on power and the presidency of Syria right now?
I mean, I think it's safe to say that, you know, Assad definitely still retains support inside of the country. His forces, or at least forces that are nominally loyal to him, control most of the country's largest cities. But at the same time, you know, Assad is now the leader of a much weakened and a much diminished state. I mean, this is a country that is largely a failed state. Half of its population has been displaced. It's produced 5 million refugees who are scattered all over the world. And, you know, the economy is destroyed. There's very little idea of when this is going to end and who's going to rebuild it. And so there does not appear to be any direct threat to his hold on what he has now. But what he has now is incredibly reduced from what he had when this whole thing started. You know, he's basically ruling over a country that is largely in ruins, that has a destroyed economy. So he's still there, but he doesn't have all that much to show for it.
Ben, thank you very much. I know it's getting late there. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
We'll be right back.
My name is Jasmine Ulloa, and I'm a national politics reporter for The New York Times. I grew up in Texas, on the border with Mexico, and I've been reporting in the region since I was in high school. Now I travel the country looking for stories and voices that really capture what immigration and the nation's demographic changes mean for people. What I keep encountering is that voters don't fall into neat ideological boxes on this very volatile issue. There's a lot of gray. And that's where I feel the most interesting stories are. I'm trying to bring that complexity and nuance to our audience, especially in such a critical election year. And that's really what all of my colleagues on the politics team and every journalist at the New York Times is aiming to do. Our mission is to help you understand the world, no matter how complicated it might be. If you want to support this mission, consider subscribing to the New York Times. You can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Oh my God, yeah. Yeah, this quote from ISIS is incredible. They explained that they, you know, their suicide bomber set off his explosive belt in this church, and then another one set off his explosive belt in this different church in Egypt. And then they say in their statement, "Let the crusaders and their henchmen among the apostates know that the bill between us and them is very large, and they will pay it with blood from their children, which will run as rivers."
Oof. Rukmini Kalamaki covers ISIS for The Times. I reached her in Iraq. Rukmini, walk me through these attacks in Egypt over the weekend. What do we know about what happened?
What we know from the reporting that The New York Times and others have done is that there were two churches, one in the city of Alexandria and one in the town of Tanta. Both of them are Coptic churches, and they were celebrating Mass on Palm Sunday. And the explosion at the church in Tanta, the attacker positioned himself next to the altar before he blew himself up. So, of course, you know, Palm Sunday is a major holiday in the Christian tradition. It's a time when even people who don't normally go to church go to church, and they show up in their Sunday best, including with their children. Right? I mean, that's what you do on Palm Sunday. So two different suicide bombers entered each of these churches a couple of hours apart, detonated their vests, and killed a total of 44 people and wounded probably dozens more.
Tell me about these Coptic Christians. Who are they and why are they being targeted?
This is basically the Christian minority in Egypt. I've heard them described as the largest Christian community in the Middle East. Their community numbers in the millions. And ISIS is targeting them much in the same way that they are targeting the Shia in Iraq and in other places. They're trying to inflame sectarian tension. Mm-hmm. You and I have spoken about the fact that ISIS is trying to eliminate what they call the gray zone, which is the zone separating extreme Islam from every other moderate Muslim. And one of the ways that they can do this is by creating a sectarian conflict. Mm. And obviously these types of attacks further that aim.
Sounds like what you're saying is it's not that they wake up and say, we must go after Coptic Christians. It's that they want to sow this conflict wherever they can.
Yes. But they're being very calculated about it. So for instance, in Egypt, there have been repeated attacks against Coptic Christians. This is at least the third that I know of. And there have been other foiled attacks that happened against that group.
And where does Egypt fit into this larger strategy that ISIS has?
Egypt has a special place in the jihad, in part because of the number of high-ranking jihadi leaders that have come from there. So, for example, Ayman Zawahiri, who is the current head of Al-Qaeda, which is the group that in the end spawned ISIS, he is himself an Egyptian doctor. Several members of Al-Qaeda's governing Shura Council are Egyptian. So I think the relationship with Egypt is somehow sewn into their DNA because of these towering figures that came from there. Now that ISIS in Libya has been to some extent degraded, I would say that Egypt is really one of their main bases in North Africa.
I want to talk about Egypt's president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi.
Yes.
He just got back from Washington.
Right.
He had a series of meetings with President Trump.
Right.
What do we need to know about him?
Well, Sisi has been widely reported, is an authoritarian leader. He has led a massive crackdown on dissenters of all kinds, including journalists, but also Islamists. So there's been a major crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood. Obviously, this attack is something that has to be unsettling for him, because the one trade-off of having an authoritarian regime is that your leader is expected to provide security. So clearly, if the Coptic Christians can't even celebrate Mass on Palm Sunday, that's something that detracts from that idea of security.
When Sisi met with President Trump, what Trump seemed to basically signal was that the reason that the United States could look past some of the brutality it has seen from Sisi, the crackdowns on journalists, on protest, on dissent, was because President Trump sees Sisi as an ally in the fight against ISIS.
Right.
And now we have these terrible attacks on Palm Sunday.
Right.
Where does that leave Sisi?
I mean, I think at some level it leaves him in a precarious position. You know, he's claiming to provide security at a time when ISIS, when their reach inside Egypt is clearly growing, and when a religious minority like the Coptic Christians are being targeted on a high holy day.
We've just been talking about Syria and Bashar al-Assad. President Trump once viewed Assad as another potential ally in the fight against ISIS, and now has turned against him and questioned whether he should even be in office. But he still views Sisi as someone he should work with to keep ISIS under control.
Mm-hmm.
But help me understand the difference between those two, perhaps on the ground, but then maybe in the eyes of the White House.
Well, Bashar al-Assad has led a full-on frontal assault on his people. There have been barrel bombings against civilians that have now been going on for years. We know that Assad's army has targeted hospitals, has targeted schools, and has really crossed the line into an unprecedented slaughter of his people. Sisi has led a massive crackdown, but it's of course not at the level of violence of Syria.
I guess the reality is it's really hard to know exactly who are the best allies of the U.S. in fighting ISIS among these leaders.
Yeah, for sure.
How are the partnerships like the one President Trump says he has struck with President Sisi of Egypt? Mm-hmm. How are they supposed to stop these attacks or can they stop these attacks?
Well, you know, it's still early in the Trump presidency, but from what we know about what he said during the campaign and in the first part of his term, it seems to be that he believes that force is going to eradicate this group. Mm-hmm. He's talked about, you know, bombing the expletive out of them. He's talked about increasing airstrikes. Force is one approach to these groups. But unfortunately, I think that America's own experience in Iraq, starting with the invasion in 2003 and going forward, has shown that force is not everything. Mm-hmm. This group was nearly eradicated through a combination of force and also through the so-called Sunni awakening in Iraq in late 2010, 2011. And yet it came back stronger than ever before. And what I think we continue to not know how to deal with is the ideology, mm-hmm. the ideas that these people are propagating. We haven't grappled with why these ideas are so attractive to people, why it is that they are able to move people to violence in such a way.
Rukmini, thank you very much. Stay safe in Iraq, and we'll talk soon.
My pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Here is what else you need to know today.
I'm personally appalled by the size, the scope, the duration, and the impact of the scandal. And I must say that I'm shocked and incredibly disappointed by the response of Wells Fargo's corporate executives.
Wells Fargo, the third biggest bank in the U.S., is demanding that two former executives return $75 million in pay in a rare form of punishment for corporate America. The bank concluded that the executives, one of them the former CEO, were to blame for a scheme revealed last year in which employees created as many as 2 million fraudulent bank accounts and credit cards to meet sales targets. And in the week since the Times reported on multiple sexual harassment allegations against Fox News host Bill O'Reilly, more than 50 companies have suspended their advertising on the O'Reilly Factor. At the same time, ratings for his show are surging. O'Reilly is now drawing about 1 million more viewers a night than he did before the story, which revealed that O'Reilly and Fox's parent company paid five women who accused him of inappropriate behavior a total of $13 million to settle those claims. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.